So what I want to do is to tell you a few things about what we are doing in my group on fermionic atom optics. I want to warn everybody that I'm not really a condensed matter person. I'm a quantum optics person, so I think the flavor will be slightly different from what at least I've heard last week. Before I start, the people who actually are doing the work, Chris Search, who is my postdoc until Friday, and then he will move on to a faculty position at Stevens. Han Pu, who was my postdoc but is now at Rice University, actually today is sitting right here. Weiping Zhang, who also was with me and now is a professor at Tsinghua University. And Taka Miyakawa, who is my postdoc still now, still not been stolen away from me. So that's good. These are my students, Dennis Douglas, Ben Calafoot, and Dominic Miser. And I also want to mention Mike Moore, with whom some of this work was started when he was my student, and now he's on the faculty at Ohio University in Athens. And these are the people who pay the bills, okay? So the reason I'm interested in cold atoms is really because I'm an optics person, and cold atoms are waves, and I'm interested in trying to figure out what one can do with matter waves in optics. And one thing that one can do is what these fellows are doing. Unfortunately, we're not quite that skilled yet, okay? So for those who were not on the trip yesterday, we crossed this incredible pod of dolphins who decided to show us what can really do with matter waves, okay? And so that's kind of the far goal of our research. But right now we have to stick to even colder water. And the first question I would like to answer is, why are we interested in matter waves in optics? And there is a view graph that pretty many of you have seen, and I want to go very, very quickly through it. But one of the things that one likes to do with optical waves, or with matter waves now, is atom interferometers. And one of the things that people are thinking of doing is using atom interferometers for inertial sensors, for rotation sensors. And if you look at a well-known effect, which is called the Sagnac effect, which is actually used to measure rotations in optical or matter wave interferometers, the signal that you get is proportional to a number of interesting things. This is the area under the interferometer. Omega is the rotation rate of the interferometer. And M is the mass of the particles that you are using in your matter wave interferometer. Now, of course, for optics, this doesn't hold anymore because photons are massless, so one has to work slightly differently, and I don't want to go through that. But basically, what happens once you go through the algebra is that the mass is replaced by the ratio of h bar omega over 2c squared. So what you find is that everything else being equal, which is a very strong assumption, you find that the sensitivity of an atom interferometer is better than the sensitivity of an optical, Maxwell waves interferometer by a factor of mc squared over h bar omega, which is typically of the order of 10 to the 11. And this is really a daunting number, because 11 orders of magnitude is not something you see every day. Now, of course, the key sentence here was everything else being equal, and everything else is not equal. So one of the key questions in atom optics is to try to figure out how many orders of magnitude we are going to lose when we work with atoms. And if we lose less than 11 orders of magnitude, we are going to be in business. If we lose more than 11 orders of magnitude, things are not going to be quite that great. Okay? But this is one of the great motivators to do atom optics. This number is just too good to ignore. Yeah? Well, neutrons, it would be the mass again, right?
Well, but this be done.
Right? And of course, neutron interferometers go back to the 60s, probably, right? And the problem is that to put a neutron interferometer in an airplane or a submarine is not so trivial. So there are some practical aspects here. And you could do electron interferometry as well, except the mass factor is not quite that great. So yes, I mean, matter wave interferometry is nothing new in principle, but with the advent of cold atoms, it looks like one can really build devices.
Okay. Can I interrupt? Why atoms, cold atoms, are better than, say, helium?
You mean the superfluid helium?
Yeah. Or
I think that the reasons, as far as I can see, that it's very easy. You don't need cryogenic systems, right? You can use laser cooling. You can make atomic beams very easily. There are all kinds of practical reasons. And you can hopefully make large atom interferometers too. There is this factor here, which is the area of the interferometer, which comes into play. So many, many practical reasons.
But there are no experiments.
Yes, of course.
Mercury and helium-3, when they
right.
were able to observe rotation.
Of course, yeah. The question is how good you can get, right? That you can do it in principle, I have absolutely no argument with that. Again, I don't want to spend too much time on that. It's more of a motivation type view graph, okay?
There's actually a serious reporting in the latest NASA meeting just because of the heat exchange program there. And there's a report on the helium inside on the
right.
Barometer. And I think it's just way down. The sensitivity at the moment is many, many orders of magnitude less than the recent experiment of Mark Cassidy.
That's right.
However, the Mark Cassidy's experiment was also challenged strongly by the person in Maryland on the
right.
Squid. And
that
he claimed that many years ago,
then
already they had achieved
squid,
they can use
the energy 4 orders of magnitude more than the current experiments. Right. So there is some debate going on. And one of the problems in this business is that as soon as you become very, very sensitive, you're no longer allowed to talk about it. and that's...
Are you serious?
Yes. Well, I'm not, because I don't have a clearance, but people like Mark Kasevich are no longer allowed to talk about how good they are.
Your lips better be sealed, too.
No, it's okay. As long as you don't have a clearance, you're safe, right? Yeah. So one has to be a bit careful there about some of the numbers which are floated around. Okay. So now the second question I would like to address is, the title of my talk is on fermionic atom optics. So the next question is, why would one want to use fermions rather than bosons? After all, we have a lot of experience, of know-how of how to deal with bosons. Everybody who does optics talks about bosons all the time. And when we go to fermions, it looks like things become much more complicated. We don't really know what we're talking about anymore, and it's not obvious that it's a good thing to do. So one of the problems that we... On the other hand, it's kind of interesting to try to generalize all the ideas of optics to fermions, because one can probably learn some new physics. So one of the things we did a couple of years back is to try to answer this question in a pseudo-realistic way by considering a Mach Zehnder interferometer, which was driven either by bosons or fermionic atomic beams. Okay, so here we could, a typical Mach Zehnder interferometer is this kind of configuration with totally reflecting mirrors, two beam splitters here, and you count photons or atoms at the two outputs of the interferometer, and one can, in principle, inject beams on one or in two arms of this interferometer. When you first start thinking about atom interferometry, you think, well, you really want to use a Bose condensate, because a Bose condensate is kind of like a laser, and we know that in interferometry it's kind of nice to work with lasers. But soon you realize that with bosons, with atomic bosons, you have a problem, and this problem is collisions, which is a problem you don't have with light. And collisions, as we know, lead to nonlinear phase shifts in the propagation of the waves. And these nonlinear phase shifts are proportional density, and if you don't control your density very well, this leads to systematic errors. Okay, so collisions are bad in many ways for precision measurements. On the other hand, fermions also have their problems because of the Pauli exclusion principle. You will not be able to make monochromatic fermionic beams. So you are going to lose there too. And then the question is, which one is better and which one is worse? So again, I'm still in the motivation part of my talk, trying to justify both doing atom optics and fermionic atom optics. So we did some calculations here, which are not very hard to do, of this system. And we basically introduced a measure of the sensitivity of these systems, which is the standard measure, which goes back to at least the work of Scaddy and co-workers, basically the sensitivity is measured by comparing the difference in counts that you get for a given imposed phase shift on your interferometer to the intrinsic quantum mechanical fluctuations that you have in your system. And this is how you measure the fluctuations in these interferometers. It's a reasonably standard thing to do. And when one does that, again, this is not very complicated to do, one can get some comparison between bosons and fermions. So let me go through this curve, through this graph a little bit. What am I plotting here? This is basically a measure of the sensitivity of the system as a function of 1 over the square root of the flux, okay, in the input beam of your Mach Zehnder interferometer. And the first three curves are for bosons, and the second curves, these two curves here, are for fermions. The first curve, the first two curves are for bosons and the last three are for fermions. So let's look at the bosons first. You see the sensitivity is worst with bosons. This first case here is in case you have, is in case you have no collisions in your system. So that's what you would get in optics. Also, you get this 1 over square root of n detection sensitivity. And you see that collisions, which are here measured in some not very interesting parameter for today's discussion, collisions, as I said, are going to ruin the sensitivity of your system rather rapidly.
You're talking about a degenerate Bose gas?
Yes, it's a T equals zero. Everything I do is T equals zero here.
So by collisions, you're really working some gross behaviors?
That's right. For instance, this is actually better than Gross-Pitayevsky, but it doesn't matter the details.
It's not inelastic collisions.
That's right. It's all elastic collisions, right? And now we have here the situation for fermions. Now, for fermions, one has to be a bit careful because one has to really realize that since you cannot put all your fermions in the same mode, you are going to, in addition to having the flux describing this system, you also have to tell people how monochromatic it is, your beam. And this is for a beam which becomes less and less monochromatic. And you see that the worse your beam is, the better the sensitivity of your system. And this is something that might bother you. And it bothered me at first until I went to talk to classical opticians. And classical opticians actually knew that. I always like to tell the story of the director of optical sciences, which is the place where I work, who made actually $80 million by knowing this. And it's kind of annoying, right? and the reason is, in a sense, very trivial. What we are really interested in measuring here is very, very small phase shifts. And if you want to measure very, very small phase shifts, and you have very non-monochromatic beams, you can take advantage of the fact that if you want the coherence length of your system is going to be very small. So as soon as you have a very tiny phase difference between the two arms of your interferometer, your signal is going to go away. On the other hand, if you have a monochromatic field, you will get a visibility which is more or less periodic, and you don't have as much sensitivity for small phase shifts. And this is something which has led to a whole industry in optics which is called white light interferometry. And white light interferometry is what is used every day in the labs in Silicon Valley to measure the flatness of chips and things like that. People who want to measure very tiny phase shifts typically do not use monochromatic fields. They use white light or quasi-white light. And this is also why suddenly fermions seem to be better than bosons. So that's kind of nice because, of course, we could also use a non-monochromatic beam of bosons, but we would still have this problem with collisions. So fermions working.
I still don't understand why the sensitivity actually increases if you're not monochromatic. Suppose I have two beams with different frequencies divided by some small amount.
Right.
And you say you can actually make use of it to detect.
Yeah, because the coherence length of your system will be very small. So if you think that if you have no optical path difference between two arms, you will always get some interferences, right?
Yeah.
But they will go away very fast. So by measuring the slope as how fast they go away, you can measure very tiny small phase shifts very easily.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. All right. So anyway, so this is one more reason why we want to do not just atom optics, but also fermionic atom optics. And this is actually work we published in 2003, and not too many people paid attention. But fortunately, just a few weeks ago now, there was a paper by the group of Ingusio, just came out in PhysRev Letters, and they did atom interferometry with trapped Fermi gases, and they say here, the experiment proves the superiority of non-interacting fermions with respect to bosons for precision interferometry. So suddenly, this whole thing becomes respectable, because experimentalists did it, right? So suddenly people believe that, and actually that's really exciting, I think, because we were hoping that somebody would do this kind of experiment, and they do them. So now I think this has become a legitimate thing to look into fermionic atom optics somewhat seriously. And I think Ingusho was here. Was he here?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So that's pretty exciting. And here again is his result where he compares fermions and bosons. The experiments are still not as clean as one would like, but they will be very soon, I'm sure. And this is an experiment done in a lattice where they look at block oscillations of atoms, of ultra-cold fermions or bosons inside an optical lattice. And they see, indeed, that because of collisions, the interference pattern is washed out very fast for bosons, because there are no collisions for fermions, if you want, your signal remains much longer. Okay, so that's our motivation if you want to do fermionic atom. Yes?
Is this some form of Hilbert limit where I have only to consider single particles at the beam splitter? Or does this change?
Well, for fermions, it would not change, right?
So I'm wondering the boson.
Well, they have collisions, so therefore.
Well, of course, the statistical properties at the beam splitter.
Yeah, they've not looked at that I know of. I'm going to go to see Ingusho in a couple of weeks, and I want to know more about the experiment. But I don't know enough detail. And PhysRev Letters, you know, it's in great wisdom, never gives you enough detail. Okay? Yeah?
What if you were able to make a BEC with no interactions?
Yeah, that would work. That would
work better than?
Well, it depends again on what you want to do. Because again, as I said, if you want to measure very small phase shifts, actually you really want to have non-monochromatic fields. Okay, so fermions give that to you for free, in a sense. So with fermions, you have both non-monochromatic fields and no collisions at the same time. So that's kind of nice. Okay. So I'm all for fermions these days. All right. So this was kind of a general introduction, but we also
large signal required. You should be able to count atoms precisely.
Right, you always have this 1 over square root of n or something like that which will pop out at some point. But of course there are other tricks. We have other tricks up our sleeves, right? We can use squeeze states and things like that, which I will not talk about today because we don't quite know how to do it yet. But hopefully we will at some point. Okay, so this is in a sense linear atom optics with fermions. But one of the things that we also like to do is nonlinear atom optics, and this is something which for bosons has been known for quite a while. And again, this is something I can go through extremely fast. If you write down the Gross-Pitayevsky equation and you have a background in optics, you realize that the equation for the mean field is very similar to the equation for a light field propagating in a Kerr medium, nonlinear Kerr medium. And out of that, you immediately realize that collisions serve as a nonlinear medium for the atoms, and you can do all kinds of nonlinear atom optics this way. And this has been done, and here are some of the examples of nonlinear atom optics experiments that people have carried out over the years. The first one was the Bill Phillips experiment on four-wave mixing. There were experiments also on matter wave phase conjugation, atom holography. Shimizu in Japan did that, atomic solitons, many, many groups. I will talk quite a bit more on second harmonic generation. Atom lasers and amplifiers have been demonstrated, in particular by Catalay's group and then several other groups. Matter wave super radiance, the list goes on and on and on, okay? And now what we would like to do is to extend these ideas to fermions, or ask the question, can these ideas of a nonlinear atom optics be extended to fermionic fields? Okay. So again, now I will say something that probably many of you know, but I want to spend at least 5 minutes on that, or 10 minutes, and then move to more recent material. So bosonic four-wave mixing, the experiments of Bill Phillips, are actually very beautiful and very elegant experiments, where they started from a condensate, as you recall, and split this condensate into three modes by using Bragg diffraction. Okay, and then while these three modes were still overlapping, they would interact with each other via elastic collisions and produce a fourth mode of the electromagnetic field, of the matter wave field. And this is the signal. This is actually an experimental result of Phillips and co-workers. And one can try to interpret this result, and there are many ways to interpret this result, and the simplest way is to say, well, this is just a stimulated scattering process where you have three waves, three of the waves interact and produce a fourth wave. And if it's a stimulated scattering process as opposed to a spontaneous scattering process, you have this nice Bose enhancement factor which makes things happen. Okay? And this is all nice and fine. And if you believe this argument, you're going to say, well, this is the kiss of death for fermionic atom optics, because in fermionic atom optics, you don't have Bose enhancement, obviously. So this explanation number one. Explanation number two is an explanation based on optics, the kind of the classical optics intuition of things. And in optics, you would say, well, what happens in this four-wave mixing experiment is that two of the beams here, two of the modes of the electromagnetic field, which have opposite momenta, are going to combine to form a density grating. And the third beam can Bragg scatter, if you want, of this grating and create a fourth mode of the matter wave field. And if you believe this explanation, it looks like this should also work with fermions, right? So the question is, which is the correct way to think about this problem? And can we do fermionic nonlinear optics? So way back then with Mike Moore, we argued back and forth about this problem, and then we decided instead of arguing, one should probably do a calculation, okay, which sometimes is useful. And then we decided to first try to figure out how the people create these matter wave gratings. How do they create the different modes of the electromagnetic field? And they do it optically. The way they do it is that they have a standing wave laser field interact with the atoms. And because a photon recoil, you can create side modes with momenta going with plus h bar k and minus h bar k of the light field, if you want, okay? And you can, of course, do that in principle with both bosons and fermions, but you will produce very different types of gratings. If you assume that you have a T equals zero bosonic field, the kind of density grating you will create is n for the n atoms you have in your ground state times the ground state wave function in your trap squared times 1 plus cos kr, where k is the momentum of the light field. Okay, so you can do that. Now for fermions, again, at T equals zero, what you're going to do is that you're going to put every single one of these fermions in a coherent superposition of the fermion and rest and the fermion with the momentum k, and this is the kind of grating you will get. So now one can actually plot these gratings for various situations. And here is what you find for a typical density grating of bosons and of fermions, and they look very similar. And this is kind of interesting, but maybe not too surprising.
So however, for bosons, you have two beams coming in, but for fermions,
you also have two beams of light.
So it's just a standard one-dimensional optical lens.
Right. It's all 1D, this calculation.
And how many fermions are you seeing we have per well?
Okay, no, that's actually, there's only one well. It's not, okay. It's not a lattice in the sense of Emmanuel Bloch. It's just atoms trapped in the magnetic traps, and you have an off-resonant light field, which produces a virtual transition to an upper level and gives a momentum kick to the atoms.
OK.
Okay.
So, each, let's say, suppose I originally, without light field, and every fermion occupy, let's say, a state which I call A, and then now with the light field, and basically I turn A into A plus B, something like that.
Right.
And then, so each state is a superposition of two.
Exactly. And we'll come back to that in one view graph in slightly.
So what is the role of the fermion surface in the fermion beam, in the fermion grating?
Okay, that's something you cannot see on this view graph because this view graph is in real space. But this is a very good point. These gratings look actually very much the same in real space, but if you go to momentum space, they are very, very different. Okay, because the width of this grating, of the bosonic grating in momentum space, is just basically the width of the trap. Okay.
In real space, it doesn't make any difference.
I'm sorry?
You mean in real space, it doesn't make any difference as far as your distance is concerned?
Right. They look very, very much the same, right? And you can always do that. You can fine-tune the shape of your trap to do that, which is what we did. So you, yeah.
What's on the vertical axis?
On which axis?
On the middle picture. Is that the
game?
I can't see the geometry.
Oh, this is a circular trap, okay? And you shine light in just one random direction, which is the direction Z, and this is a 3D rendition of the density modulations of your field.
So wavelength of your light is small compared to the extent of the cloud.
Right. Yeah. So you can do that, and you see that in real space these gratings look the same, provided you tweak your potentials a little bit. But in momentum space, they will also always be different because you always have width in momenta with the fermion. The question is, what happens if you try to scatter some probe beam of this case, fermions in that case and bosons in that case? Of course, we have to be a bit careful because for the fermions, we have to use two different spins. Otherwise, we won't have any collisions, right?
Oh, so you want a delta K is really larger than fermi.
Right.
Otherwise, it would mess things up.
Absolutely, yeah. Right.
So with more like single particle scattering, basically. So, well, basically you want to produce two particles with K plus
right.
K, but then around it and then.
Right. So you have two bulbs. You see, you have two little momenta packets. Okay. So the optical light field is much larger. K is much larger than the Fermi moment. Right. Otherwise, it's actually very interesting what happens otherwise. But I don't want to do that. Yeah, you probably would see that, but we've not looked for that. We were really concentrating on trying to generate just this four-wave mixing. So then we scattered particles in both cases, and we find that the four-wave mixing signal is essentially the same in both cases, which was a big surprise for us. And it was a big surprise for most of the people in this business, except for Wolfgang Ketterle, who is never surprised because he's so darn smart, okay? So then we tried to figure out a little bit better why it was the case, and it turns out that the explanation is actually very, very simple. Again, at least if you have a background in optics.
If K is the momentum shift much smaller than Fermi.
Then you have to be very careful because if your Fermi is filled, you cannot move atoms, right? So you will have Pauli blocking. So you can always move from near the Fermi surface then.
You still have Friedel oscillation.
Yeah, you probably would, but this is again not Friedel oscillations.
This is not, I'm saying.
Right.
But if the K is much smaller than K, don't
you
have?
I've not done the calculation, but I would suspect that you do.
But you're on the opposite.
Yeah,
right.
I understand.
Right.
So in this case, Friedel oscillation is very small.
So.
Actually, for me, I'm just the most surprising issue is the same picture for Bose and Fermi, because for me, surprise arises exactly at this step.
Right.
Once I see this special grating, nothing can surprise me any longer or more than this special grating, because what I would expect, I have some distribution of particles in terms of momentum, which in my just naively would behave like smearing out
right.
Anything in real space. And when I see this grating, it's this is the explanation.
It's not complete explanation though.
But at least surprise starts for me exactly at this point. So why just?
Okay, it should not surprise you yet.
Why?
What? I'm sorry.
Because I kept particles distributed all over my plant, in contrast to just one particle state.
But you know that you can make gratings with non-monochromatic light fields too. That shouldn't—it's always a question of numbers, right? Uh-huh. Right.
When a K difference is so large,
right? But I don't want to spend too much time, and I'm kind of running late, so I will not give you the full explanation of why it is the same. I will give you a one view graph explanation.
If I just change the temperature from, say, zero to some finite, essentially comparable to Fermi energy, will grating disappear? Or
eventually, it will disappear. Yeah, eventually. But it has to be quite a high temperature, right? Because
much larger than
right.
Fermi.
Yeah.
But you can't control by the
right. So I want to tell you in one view graph then why it is the case that you can do. I will not show all these things. I wish I had time, but this is really the answer to why it works, okay? And the reason this works is just quantum interference, but not Bose enhancement, just more trivial quantum interference. And the way to understand it, you can just go to two atoms only. Surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, and maybe you want to remember, maybe I should remind you because so many people here are so young that you probably don't remember Dickey. But in 1954, Dickey made a very clever observation. He observed that if you have two-level atoms, and that you put them in a coherent superposition of one of them in the excited state and the other one in the ground state, plus the other way around. Then you would get something called super radiance. The system would radiate spontaneously much faster than you would for individual atoms. If you have just two atoms, the factor of enhancement is a factor of square root of two. And it is just because of a quantum interference effect, because they have basically two ways to go to the same final state from the initial state. And these days, these are called entangled states. Okay? But Dickey talked about that very, very much earlier. Now you can try to figure out what happens with our fermions. And what happens with our fermions is the following. Initially, we have one fermion in the ground state of the trap and one in the first excited state of the trap. And when you put this light beam on this system to impart momentum onto the atoms, every one of these atoms can either not get the momentum or get it. So the final state that you prepare, the state of your grating, is a superposition of state where the atom, which was initially in the ground state of the trap, still has k equals zero momentum, and the state in the excited state of the trap is given a momentum of k, or the other way around. So you see that the way these gratings are prepared in this experiment, you create an entangled state. Okay, the difference being that in the normal Dickey state, the state that you prepare is symmetric with respect to which atom is in an electronically excited state. And in this way of preparing a grating, the state of the system is symmetric with respect to which of the trap levels is in which momentum state, okay, center of mass momentum state. But otherwise, it's exactly the same. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the way you prepare this grating and the way you prepare Dickey super radiance. And therefore, you get an enhancement factor which is the same square root of 2 or square root of n that you would have, yeah?
Okay, so entangled states decohere, and there's always decoherent time, and that's
right.
Vital in quantum information, but I don't see how super radiance decoheres. I don't understand why it works.
Well, it will decohere, and I don't want to get into that here. Actually, we submitted a paper a few months ago on the decoherence of this system, because this system, in the language of optics, would be inhomogeneously broadened, and this inhomogeneous broadening will lead to decoherence. So yes, it will. But for short enough times, you will get very similar response for bosonic systems and for fermionic system, provided that you've prepared the system initially in this entangled state.
Can you give a sense of the time scale and real numbers? calculation?
Well, it depends on how many atoms you have and the width of your Fermi surface, but it's going to be basically 1 over the Fermi energy, more or less.
Okay.
Give or take, yeah.
You have your laser on the whole time, right?
Right. Well, you don't need to, but typically you do, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I'm a bit confused about what is the electronic state of the third group of atoms?
They're all in the ground electronic state.
Why don't they get excited?
Because you don't want to do that. Because if you work with cold atoms, the last thing you want to have is spontaneous emission. So you excite the systems far off resonance.
Yes, but why? I mean, they're coming to the same region of physical space. Why are they not equally subject to the laser field?
They are, but what you do is you do virtual transitions, assuming there are two-level atoms, and you just go like that.
But
of course the third beam that you have has to have a different spin state, otherwise they will not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But ground state, that ground electronic state, different spin. Otherwise you're dead.
So it's important that there's no Pauli principle between the third.
Yeah, otherwise you won't get any interaction. Yeah, I'm sorry, I said it, but probably too fast. Yeah. Okay. Now another point, which, and I want to come back to Boris' comment, that he said, once I see that I can have a grating, therefore it's trivial. And it's not, because if you're grating...
It's trivial, but at least it's understandable.
No, but you could create a grating without creating an entanglement. And if you created a grating without creating this entanglement, you would not get any four-wave mixing.
But if I have a modulation of density and I...
It's not enough. You really need to have, entanglement. So... And in a sense, if you think of Bose enhancements, it's also a similar effect, right? That it's just many routes which lead to the same.
Bose, everything is straightforward because I can speak classical language. The language.
And here you right.
That's right. I see no reason for speaking the language of classical field.
Right.
I just give you an arbitrary fermion system with a density modulation unit.
Right.
Of one spin species. Right. And then send some beam of atoms of the other
spin.
Surely they will get automatically refracted.
But will you get an enhancement? That's really the question. You will get some diffraction.
Yeah,
certainly. And the question is whether you get enhancement.
The difference between this and the classical potential
comes
from this entanglement.
So right.
Since your scattering beam is
at
a first spin state, so it doesn't distinguish whatever this.
Exactly. So you have two routes which lead to the same final state. It's the old Feynman argument.
It's not obvious, but then that's a remarkable part of his aim. So we understand later.
Yeah. Actually, before we arrived at this result, we had an extremely time-dependent answer to this problem.
What's the current...
No, we know that we believe that this is correct, but when my student and I were working on that, every day we had another answer, pretty much.
Okay.
It was not complete trivial when
it's
we did.
Now the steady-state answer.
Oh, yeah. Well, we hope. You know, there's always decoherence, right? Yeah. Actually... What makes me feel really good about that is that at exactly the same time when we wrote that, Wolfgang Ketterle and his group reached the same conclusion, and it's almost as good as an experiment. Okay, so what I wanted to do next is to talk a little bit about three-wave mixing. Now, three-wave mixing is an interesting problem because if you go back to the history of nonlinear optics, three-wave mixing, second harmonic generation, these kind of things were the first effects seen by Peter Franklin and his co-workers in nonlinear optics. So the question would be, can we do this elementary experiment with atoms? And obviously, the immediate answer would be well, no, because you have a conservation of the number of atoms, so how can you make one atom out of two? And this is when we get into molecules. Say, well, you may not do it with atoms, but you may actually be able to do this with molecules. And this is why the other day I was so excited about heteronuclear molecules, because it gives us more things to play with. So again, this is something that I'm sure you've talked a lot during this workshop. The beautiful experiments of Debbie Jin, who produced a molecular condensate, and then even more interesting things out of pairs of fermions in different spin state. And this is a great motivation for us to start playing with molecules and with atoms, because in a sense, from a quantum optics point of view, you can think of it as a three-wave mixing process. You create one molecule out of two fermions, so it's really a three-wave process, right? Now, again, because my background is in quantum optics, we are not typically interested in ground state properties of systems. Other people do that. What we are more interested in is in dynamics and in manipulating fields. So the question that we want to answer is, can we actually, now that we know that molecular fields can be created in the lab, can we actually manipulate and control these fields? For instance, can we make squeezed molecular fields? Can we make, you know, molecular fields with very interesting statistical properties? And then can we use them to make interest for interesting applications? And one model that we've been considering quite a bit in the last few months is something which is very reminiscent of something called a micromaser in quantum optics. And since you probably don't know what a micromaser is, or maybe not all of you do, I want to very briefly remind you of what a micromaser is. A micromaser is a maser, an optical electromagnetic maser, which produces light fields or microwave fields by building them one photon at a time, if you want. So the way these systems work is as shown here. You have a microwave cavity. These are typically cavities with extremely high Q. Photons live for a very, very long time in these cavities, on the order of a second or so. And what you do is that you send atoms inside these cavities, one atom at a time. And by tuning exactly the rate at which the atoms enter, the way they enter, how long they stay in the cavity, you can pretty much make an electromagnetic field which has any statistical properties you might like to have. So this is summarized here. Normal lasers, in a sense, are boring from a point of view of quantum optics, because they pretty much create global coherent states. And they're nice states, but they are, in a sense, maybe not very interesting anymore. On the other hand, micromasers can produce things which are called non-classical states, such as squeeze states or number states, sub-Poissonian states, states with bimodal photon distributions, all kinds of wonderful things. And they also undergo things which people in the business call phase transitions, and one should take that with a grain of salt, because it's very hard to justify talking about phase transitions when you have a system of 10 or 15 particles. So we should put a large number of quotation marks here. But anyway, they have crossovers or whatever you want to call these things. So the question we asked ourselves is, can we do something similar for matter wave fields and get into the business of cavity, the matter wave analog of cavity QED? So that was the motivation we had. And this is, again, what happens in a normal micromaser. This is something I stole from the group of Walter in Munich. What am I showing on this curve? I'm showing what happens as you cool down the microwave cavity, the optical cavity that they have, down to a few millikelvin. There are two curves here. This blue curve here shows the mean photon numbers in the cavity as a function of the speed at which the atoms cross the cavity. And you see all kinds of very interesting structure in this system. You see that this kind of laser has a sequence of quote-unquote thresholds, all kinds of very strange behavior. The red curve here is basically the second moment of the photon distribution in the system. If it's below this line, it's what we call non-classical light. This red line here would correspond to a coherent field. So you see now that by tuning the interaction time of the atoms with this cavity, you can pretty much create microwave fields of any properties you want, and that's what we would like to do now for the molecular field.
What, sorry, can you just say a few words about why some more and more lines revealed as temperatures rose?
Yes, I could tell you that, and I will since you asked. But what really happens in this system, it's all based on two-level physics, two-level atom physics. And when the atoms fly through the cavity, there are some situations when, during the time it takes them to fly through the cavity, they undergo exactly a 2-pi pulse or a 4-pi pulse. So they go up, I mean, they go down and back up. So they do not deposit any energy in the field. And these are these features that we see here. It could be 2-pi pulse or 4-pi pulse or things like that. Now, why is it that this structure disappears as you increase the temperature? It is because this is microwave optics, and thermal photons are always around in microwave. And so as you increase the temperature, these microwave photons wash out these effects. Right, yeah. Okay, so how do we suggest? Okay, the micromesa theory is very simple in a sense. You have the interaction between the atoms and the single mode of the field, which is a very good approximation because you have a single mode, extremely good cavity. And then you have the pump, which is basically describing the injections of the atoms inside this cavity. And you have dissipation because you always have dissipation. And you can actually solve this problem almost exactly. Okay, so can we do something similar for the molecular field? That's the question we wanted to ask. And so what do we need? First, we need a resonator. And in optics, they have these absolutely fancy superconducting resonators that they can use. In matter wave optics, we have resonators built in. They are just optical lattices, for instance, an optical potential, so magnetic traps or whatever you want. And these have been used very much like they are used in optics. These are the old experiments of Brian Anderson, who used optical lattices to make the analog of a Q-switched, a mode-locked laser. And again, these experiments of Emmanuel Bloch, which I don't need to talk about. So we have cavities. We can make extremely good cavities in principle by making them deep enough. What about the analog of the atom field interaction, which in the micromesa is just a two-level atom interacting with a single mode of the light field? Well, we have two things that we can, in principle, play with. One of them is using Feshbau resonances, or we could also use photoassociation. And what I want to show you is that this is actually very similar to what happens in the so-called James Cummings of quantum optics. This is what I'm going to show you here. Supposing that we start with two fermions which have different spins, and we do a photoassociation or Feshbau resonance or whatever you want to call it, and create a molecule, the Hamiltonian which deals with that, I is the site index for later reference. So you annihilate two fermions, you create a molecule. If you do photoassociation, chi of t is a coupling constant, which you can turn on and off by turning on and off laser fields. Okay, so it's very easy to tune in principle. And now there is an old mapping, which goes back, I think, to Anderson, which allows you to map fermionic operators to Pauli spin operators. And in this mapping, the ground state corresponds to no fermions around an excited state with one fermion in each spin state. So if you actually assume now that the molecules, that your trap is such that you have no tunneling between wells for now, the molecules are in a insulator state, we neglect all tunneling. We also assume that the trap is tight enough that whatever fermions you have will have to be in the ground state of the trap. You have a one-to-one mapping between the James Cummings model and this photoassociation model. The only difference being these terms in blue, which I will come back in a second. So let's look first at the terms in green. This is the molecular field. This is the number of molecules that we're going to build up, hopefully, in this system. This describes the fermions. And this term describes the annihilation of two fermions and the creation of one molecule. Or the other one, yes?
What do you assume about the ratio of the molecular size and, well,
Yeah, they would have to be comparable, right?
Yeah. In that case, don't you have to worry about even counting as a Buddha, because your molecule is now not physically distinct from two permionic states in some sense?
Yeah, there is this problem which one could have. You're right. We talked about it actually last year already. Yeah. And I'm not quite sure how to deal with that quite yet. The problem is, how do you distinguish a molecule from being two fermions?
Yeah, if one of the spin states involved is the same, then you have a count basically it's the same thing.
It's always this same problem, right? Yeah. But we could, in principle, make traps which are sufficiently different for the molecules and the fermions, which.
Why do the molecule has to be large?
Why do they want to be?
Why would your molecule has to be large? Can you make your molecule small enough so that you could distinguish?
Well, usually you create these things very close to the dissociation.
Yeah.
Right. That's right. So one could imagine a scheme where we then bring them down very fast some other way. So this is a toy model right now. So the difference between this and the old micromaser problem is, of course, now we have collisions between the molecules, and also we have collisions between molecules and fermions, and collisions between fermions at different spins. Yeah?
So, Pierre, you had pumping.
I've not yet talked about the pumping. It's coming on the. No, this is basically if you are familiar with the micromaser, this is the part which is the analog of a single two-level atom interacting with the light field. This is replaced now by two fermions interacting via photoassociation to make a molecule. I still have to tell you how I bring the two fermions inside the cavity.
I also meant the two atoms are in the presence of another external driving field, strong field. Yeah.
So, but now we have to figure out how we bring these two atoms at a time inside this cavity, and the way we thought about doing it is by starting from fermions which are not trapped, and again using a Raman transition to bring two fermions at a time into a state which can be magnetically trapped, for instance. And in principle, this should work. And if you assume that this pump mechanism, now this is the pump mechanism, is on long enough, you can make sure that you put, with very close to unit certainty, two fermions at a time inside this system. And you cannot put more than two if your trap is tight enough that you cannot excite to the next trap level. Okay. Again, these are things that one can do in principle. You seem worried. No? Okay. Right. That's right. Exactly. And then the last thing that we need to do is to put the losses, and the losses we do them the way quantum optics people do them. We just describe all these nasty collisions by some master equation, okay? Which may or may not be right because there are issues about Markov approximation. But again, I want to sweep them under the rug for today. And if you do that, then you have a micromaser-like model. To describe this, the creation of this molecular field, the difference being again that we have collisions. And now the beauty is that this system can be solved almost exactly. So without having to make any kind of factorization approximation, you can really solve this problem very, very almost exactly, provided that the photoassociation steps, which are labeled by tau here, are short compared to the decay time. So the way you would prepare this system is very much like in a micromaser. In a micromaser, what do? You put a single atom inside the cavity, it interacts. If you're lucky, it deposits a photon inside the field. And then you wait for a while until you send the next atom. And the beauty of doing things this way is that you can pretty much neglect damping and all these nasty things while you have the two-level atom interacting with the light field. Likewise here, if we assume that the photoassociation steps are short compared to the damping steps, we can solve this problem essentially exactly. Okay? And I don't want to go...
I just want to understand what problem you're solving. So what is the initial state? You
So initial state, we have nothing. We just have a trap. And then we have the pump. We bring two fermions into this trap. And we can do that. Because of blockade, this is never going to be a big problem. And then you turn on your photoassociation field for some short time and hopefully create a molecule.
And that's what this T0T1
is. That is this tau. And then you let your system do whatever it wants. During this time, you will have some dissipation due to three-body collisions. You will have two new atoms, two new fermions bring into the trap. And here, you put the photoassociation step again. So it's like bringing atoms one at a time inside the cavity. And now you can tune the separation between these events and do all these things very much like...
So in between, then you would have a quantum state that is a mixture of the,
right.
of the molecule...
With maybe still two fermions here.
Some fermion field.
Right, exactly.
Why is it important that you're dealing with fermions?
Because this mapping doesn't work with bosons, this Anderson mapping that I showed you. That's the only reason. So it's expediency, the word. Okay.
Do you extract some particles from the system?
Well, eventually, yeah, we want to, you know, it's like in a laser. Eventually, you would like to get something out, right? But it's very easy to take them out. You turn off your trap, right? It's actually easier than in lasers. That would be the most simple way. So you could build your field until the place where you want it, and then you could, in principle, extract your molecular field. So since I'm really running kind of late, here is an example of what happens, the buildup of the molecular field in one of these schemes. You start with no, so what am I plotting here? Time is here, going this way. This is the probability of having n molecules in the trap as a function of n. And you see that initially you have none, so your molecular field is in the vacuum, and you see how you can build up a molecular field. And in this case, we create a molecular field which has more or less Poisson statistics for this example that we have here. But we don't need to do that. And this is actually the mean molecule number in the field. As here is a measure of the collisions. Here is the mean molecule number. Here is something which we like to call a pump parameter. It's not really too important what it is for today. And you see, it is very, very similar to what we had in the micromeasure, which is not so too surprising. If you have no collisions, beta equals zero, we get exactly the same thing, again, with this sharp structure that we talked about. And collisions tend to wash out this structure. Okay, so it's the mean molecule number in steady state. This is the molecule statistics, again, as the function of the pump parameter of this system. Here is n, and here you see this thing somewhat better. This is the contour plots, and again, you see these very, very narrow structures in the system. So what it shows is that we can, in principle, with a scheme of this kind, which needs to be, of course, refined to be more realistic, one can create molecular fields in pretty much any state we want in this system. So it's much nicer, in a sense, than just waiting for a system to reach its steady state and the steady state be whatever it wants. Here we can really control this field. And what one can then think of doing is to use quantum control techniques to really gear this field to anything you want. Yeah?
What is the time scale again? Is it again related to Fermi energies? These are fermions, only two fermions per site, so it must be something else.
Well, I don't recall it right now, but of course the time scale is governed by how strong your photoassociation lasers are. Also.
The reason I ask is because in order to have your molecules within the wells, they have to be, you know, not too long range.
Right.
So you can't be too close to the resonance, so the decay times are rather, rather short.
That's right.
So do the times, you don't put the numbers in, at least for your toy model, and the times work out?
Yes, and I don't remember them offhand, but I have them in my office. But it's milliseconds. I don't know if it's 100 milliseconds or 10 milliseconds, things of this one. Yeah, it's not minutes. So you don't need to be worried about that. Yeah?
Are the nonlinear terms included in this plot?
This particular plot, not, but the one I showed before had them. Okay, it's just the curve I happened to dig out from my computer. So you get very similar things if you put the collisions, except all this structure gets softened.
Yeah, okay. I guess the problem that Tommy raised may be become important as the molecular population
becomes large. That's right. So you will note that we never go past 20 or 30 molecules. They're not very, very strong fields. But we have an answer to this question, too, we think. Yes?
So in this setup, you just have a cell well, just one well, no tunneling.
I'm very glad you asked, because now I can go to, OK, let's forget that. Let's go about tunneling. And this is work in progress, the tunneling. But this is something we worried about, first of all, because it's something everybody's talking about that these days. But more importantly, again, if you have a laser physics background and you know that you have a very weak laser, but you would like to make a very strong laser, what you do is you make an array of lasers which all are phase locked. And you get phase locked lasers where you can get very high, you know, output without having a large output in every single cavity. So here we say, well, maybe we cannot have more than 20 molecules, but if we have 10,000 wells, we might be in business. Well, we can't do 10,000, so we do two. And this is work that we are working on right now. And so what we do now is we include the coupling between wells, which is described here. And since time is running short, let me just show you some results that we have for the steady state coherence of this system. So this is all steady state here, depending on the ratio between mean field interaction and tunneling rate. And what we find as a function of U over J is that the first order coherence of this field, which is defined here, it's really BL dagger B right plus B right dagger BL. So this is E1, E2. Okay, in classical optics, that's the same coherence function. And we see that this coherence function seems to be maximum when U over J is equal to 1. This is, again, a steady state value. It goes away, the coherence goes away for large collisions, when collisions dominate, which is not very surprising. It also seems to go away in the regime where collisions are very weak compared to the tunneling. And this is a bit more surprising, but I will tell you why in a minute. Yeah. and one can go to higher order correlations. See, the beauty of this problem is that one can compute pretty much everything exactly without having to rely to Hartree-Fock or fancy techniques like that, because the model is sufficiently simple that we can go at studying the dynamics in some detail. So the question is, what happens here? And what happens here is shown better on the next view graph. What happens is that the photo association pulse in these examples is rather short, so one excites both the symmetric and the anti-symmetric mode of this cavity, of this double well, and therefore the phase distribution of this system, if we use a Barnett, Peg Barnett type of phase definition, is double peaked with a peak at zero and a peak at pi. And of course, if you look at first order coherence, if you have these opposite phases here, it would appear to be incoherent, but one has to be a bit careful about that. By contrast, if you're in a collision-dominated system, you see that the phase, which starts being randomly distributed as a function of time, remains randomly distributed. On the other hand, in an intermediate regime, the relative phase of the two wells, which are, by the way, pumped incoherently from one another, starts randomly distributed, and then you build up a macroscopic relative phase between the two wells. And we can see in real time how this happens in this problem. So I'm really running late, so I'm sorry. So what I wanted to do now is to conclude with a little bit of an outlook. What we want to do next is to introduce techniques of quantum control and coherent control to really tweak molecular fields any way you want. We want to move to fermionic molecules too. The molecules we had here were bosonic. And now I'm very, very excited since last week about heteronuclear molecules, because I think that these are really a dream molecule for atom optics, because you can also manipulate them with electric field gradients and the kind of things that Gerhard Meyer, for instance, is doing in Berlin, but now using it for ultra-cold molecules. We need to worry very much about how we are going to detect these systems. That's always a big issue with neutral particles. And then we want to extend this toward cavity Debreuil optics also more in the future to really be able to manipulate matter wave fields with the goal of having some useful applications in the future. So I should quit here. Thank you very much.
Questions? But here, let me ask this first question. Here, so what? So were you able to use up the 11 order magnitudes that you mentioned before?
What was that?
Well, you didn't say that in order for the atom interferometry to be successful, I would not be able to destroy all this 11 or 11 order
right.
magnitudes. So how many order magnitudes one has?
I think that they have destroyed only 9 orders of magnitude.
Mostly from what?
Mostly from the fact that if you make an optical interferometer, there was this area which comes into the Sagnac effect, and it's very, very easy to make a huge area. You use a fiber and you make many, many thousands of windings. Atom interferometers are always very small, and that's the major problem here. And then the flux, of course, is not that great, but the flux is not as much. The real issue is how do you make the area larger? And I think heteronuclear molecules might be a way to go, because now you can make very large, maybe, storage rings. By very large, I mean maybe centimeter size, okay, for these molecules. Plus, you gain a bit in the mass. You gain probably a factor of 2 or 3 in the mass. And so it's not hopeless. Very large. That's right. The problem is that you need a reactor behind you, right?
Yes.
that's the problem. But you're right, there was these experiments of Rauch and co-workers. Actually, I don't know, is the Grenoble system still working again? It was down for many years. But that's the problem of neutron interferometry.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in principle, you're right, they can do wonderful things.
I would like to come back to this molecule laser you mentioned at the end. So the bottom line of your two-well setup is that you actually get enhancement of the...
Well, you know, these two guys are going to be locked. They're going to become phase-locked. And once you have two fields which are phase-locked, if you add them, you get a so-called n-squared enhancement.
Okay, but what about the role of interactions? So, let's say repulsive interactions among...
Oh, the interaction was included in this calculation.
I think it's all repulsive, as I understand.
Well, we did both, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Symmetric, your results, right?
Right. Yeah.
So you point out that the gain in sensitivity, phase sensitivity, comes from the white light aspect.
Right.
So can I go just to finite temperature to make the...
With fermions, I think, yeah, I think you're right. I think it's not really very essential that you're degenerate. I think you could go to finite temperature. You don't want to go to too high a temperature, because then S-wave scattering comes back in, right? I mean, scattering comes back in. You want to really make sure that you don't have collisions. The whole idea of going to fermions was to avoid collisions in that particular example.
But as long as they stay in the
right.
regime.
Absolutely, I think.
Well, crudely speaking, I think the condition to stay in the S-wave regime is the condition to strongly degenerate.
Is that right? How strongly? I don't know. Yeah.
Well, the scattering, the S-wave scattering is supposed to go like, I can't remember, it's T squared at some power of T.
I don't know.
It's T over TF, I don't know.
Is that right?
Some power.
But you don't need to be too deeply, I don't know. But it's a good, but in principle, yeah.
That's just the T-wave angle momentum barrier that you need to freeze out. I don't think that is directly related to the gravity
So what's, are you asking about the collision rate? What's the question with regards to scattering?
How far up can you go in temperature and
what
still?
What impression do you get S-wave scattering if you go to the finite temperature?
T over TF squared.
Yeah.
T over TF squared?
Yeah, there's two fermions. You get two factors of power.
That's what I
would
get.
Okay, but
those
are pre-multiplied factor,
which must have to do with the length of the temperature. Okay. So tomorrow, Valdin is going to give a talk at 12. So bring your lunch.